Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei rejects talks with the United States, saying problems with America can only be resolved by letting Washington hold Iranians to ransom. An Israeli man succumbs to wounds he sustained in bombings that hit the occupied Al-Quds city earlier this week. And Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan vows to fight with his last drop of blood in his first public address since being shot in an attempt on his life. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. Now, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has rejected negotiations with the U.S., saying talks with Washington will not bear fruit. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran's problems with America can only be resolved by letting Washington hold Iranians ransom. Leader warned in order to put an end to antagonism, U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, change its constitution, and restrict its influence within its borders. Ayatollah Khamenei added no Iranian can accept such conditions. He made the comments in an address to a group of Basij force members in the capital, Tehran. Leader said the Basij force should be well aware of the country's main enemy, which is global arrogance. Ayatollah Khamenei added enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of Iran. That's because the U.S. wants to dominate the minds of the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 and said the revolution tipped the balance against the favor of arrogant powers in West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. Leader added the creation of the usurper Israeli regime was in line with those policies to maintain dominance over the region. Hakima Sagiabidia is an academic and political analyst. She joined us earlier with her take on the speech delivered by a leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
You know, when you look at U.S. history of relations with other countries, you see that the United States looks at the countries around the world in as one of two cases. One is a client country and the other is an enemy country. An enemy is a country that systematically acts independent of the United States, doesn't want to give ransom to the United States, and, you know, looks for its own interests rather than, trying to take care of the interests of the United States in its region. That is the role that the clients play. Now, Iran, with its revolution, became one of the main enemies of the United States. That is not what we did, but that is what the United States eyes, Iran becomes an enemy just by having a revolution that makes it independent. So here, there are two scenarios. One is that a country is weak enough for the United States to be able to overthrow it, as you know the United States has done in some countries where they had revolutions. For example, in Congo, they had a revolution. They had an independence from the Belgians. And then over a period of 1 year, you know, they had a coup and they removed Patrice Lumumba and they killed him and everything was over, okay? And they had a friendly government, so to speak. But sometimes you have a country like Iran, which is more resilient, that doesn't, you know, old tactics sometimes don't work. So you need to have a step-by-step and a more hybrid scenario for dealing with that country. And that is what has happened with Iran, that from the beginning, many different, instruments have been used. One of them is negotiations, so to call. But I would like to say that it is not negotiations, but it is coercive diplomacy.
Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says the U.S. has resorted to soft power using propaganda campaigns to dominate Iran.
It's really important that this kind of, if you like, soft power war that the Americans are now resorting to increasingly is outed and is highlighted, and that people both within Iran and outside Iran should be educated about it. Because having failed with the hard power, essentially the Americans have no ability to be able to invade Iran or to attack it in any way physically, because Iran's military prowess is far too progressed now. They really just can't do it. So they've been left with one option, and that is by creating and financing hundreds of these anti-Iranian, anti-Islamic Republic channels, news channels, outlets, funding lots of influence on social media, deliberately targeting the Iranian media space with cultural, psychological operations, essentially, by essentially trying to corrupt or lure or entice particularly young people towards a kind of a glitzy, glamorous culture, which is pretty much non-existent, but they sell it to a lot of people, the TikTok generation, as I call them. That's their last card that they can play, and the clock is tick-tocking, because the Islamic Republic of Iran has cut deals with China, Russia, the Eurasian axis is an inevitability. The Belt Road Initiative makes Iran absolutely pivotal to a new kind of multipolar world in which America doesn't get its own way.
An Israeli man has succumbed to his injuries sustained in rare bombings that hit occupied Al-Quds earlier in the week. Now the death brings to two number of Israelis killed in the attacks, which also left 13 others wounded. On Wednesday, two explosions ripped through bus stops in the city, which security forces said were detonated remotely. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks. Bombings came amid a spike in violence, which has claimed the lives of 6 Israelis and 14 Palestinians this month across the occupied West Bank. A member of the Israeli Knesset is escalating tensions in Al-Quds and the West Bank by calling for extrajudicial executions of Palestinian resistance leaders. And this comes in the wake of 2 bombings in Al-Quds. Double bombing was the first in the city in years.
Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right member of the Israeli Knesset, has called for the extrajudicial executions. He is now to become Israel's Minister of National Security, giving him much more power than he had before. That power is quickly turning into a tool for him to pursue his extremist anti-Arab agendas. Just to put the extremism into perspective, Ben-Gvir and his allies hope to grant total immunity to Israeli soldiers who shoot at Palestinians and also impose the death penalty on Palestinians who attack Jewish people. For even more perspective, he made the headlines just before the Israeli elections as he called on the police to shoot Palestinian stone throwers as he held a pistol in his hand. Now being in charge of the Ministry of National Security, he has the power to implement his racist agendas that he's been advocating for years. Ben-Gvir's far-right party is called Otzma Yehudit, which translates into Jewish power. This party also has been fittingly called Kahanist and anti-Arab. Kahanist because the members of this party owe a lot of their racist ideologies to a racist rabbi by the name of Meir Kahane. He had called for a ban on Arab-Jewish intermarriage, as well as mass expulsion of Palestinians. His ideas were, in fact, so repugnant that the U.S. listed his party as a terrorist group, and he was even banned from Israeli parliament, the Knesset. He was unsurprisingly assassinated by an Arab in 1990. His ideologies, however, live on, as Itamar Ben-Gvir recently paid his tribute at an annual memorial still held to this date to revive the Otzma Yehudit party's pledge of allegiance to the slain Jewish supremacist rabbi.
He never since disowned Rabbi Meir Kahane or his legacy. In this passive regard, he's part of that racist legacy, but he was never caught saying anything like that publicly himself. That is why he remains within the political arena, and in recent years also much more firmly within it.
While Ben-Gvir was booed by the audience for saying, "I am not Rabbi Kahane and I do not support the deportation of all Arabs," he did also say, "Ultimately, Rabbi Kahane was about love. Love for Israel without compromise, without any other consideration." He was cheered later for vowing to expel what he called terrorists from Israel. With his newfound power alongside Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party, Israel is expected to have its most religious cabinet to date, which in Zionist terms means the most extremist Israeli administration to date.
And fears are growing over how this new Israeli administration, whose security now falls under the reins of a deeply problematic man, can worsen tensions in Al-Quds and the West Bank. tensions that have already been on the rise as a result of the expansion of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
We know that tensions are going to be heightened with the installment of Ben-Gvir from his most recent visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the city of Al-Quds. During his visit, protected by Israeli police, he shouted that we are the masters of the house here, almost to provoke a response from Palestinians. But Palestine isn't scared. Israel, however much it tries to portray itself as an impenetrable fortress, has never known peace since the occupation began in 1948. Even though it has struck normalization deals with certain Arab nations, trying to dethrone the issue of Palestine as the number one concern in the Muslim world, and even though it is backed to the hilt by the US and EU, whether politically or militarily, Israel is far from the safe haven it likes to portray itself as being. What has been happening in the occupied West Bank, with Israel's efforts to repress protests with brutal violence, indicates that the Palestinian liberation struggle is entering a new phase, when once extremist fringe settlers are now seeing themselves represented at the top levels of Israeli administrations and are backed by the police, they become emboldened and extremely brash and out of control. Neighborhoods in Al-Quds have seen Palestinians burning tires and dumpsters and throwing firecrackers at raiding Israeli forces and even lighting police vehicles on fire. The complete immunity of Israel and the empty gestures by international bodies is pushing Palestinians into a full-scale revolt, a third intifada perhaps. If that were to happen, Israel's luck might just run out this time in their effort to save face on the international sphere, and if they do lose face, the conflict will take a very different shape.
U.S. military says that one of its bases in northeast Syria has come under rocket attack, third such attack in 9 days. The two rockets reportedly targeted a patrol base in Al-Shadadi late Friday. We don't know who fired the rockets, but we know they caused no injuries or damage to the base. Now hundreds of American troops are still in Syria as part of what the U.S. calls a fight against remnants of Daesh terrorists. American troops in the region support Kurdish militants. Now about a week ago, rockets targeted America's Green Village base, which is in Syria's largest oil field, the Al-Omar. According to the U.S. military, a Turkish drone strike this week killed two Kurdish militants and posed a risk to U.S. troops in northeastern Syria. Attacks on U.S. military bases in the region, mainly in Iraq, have increased in recent years as anti-American sentiments are running high. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his supporters assembled near Islamabad on Saturday, urging the government to step down and hold fresh elections. In his first public address since being shot in an attempt on his life earlier this month, Khan vowed to fight with his last drop of blood, Nasir Kazmi reports.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following U.S.-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the U.S. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought to a U.S. conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen has resigned as head of a ruling party which suffered a defeat in Saturday's local elections. Tsai said election results were not as expected, adding she'll take all the responsibility for the defeat. Democratic Progressive Party has lost 4 of 6 mayoralties up for grabs, including in the capital, Taipei. The opposition KMT, a pro-China party, has declared victory. KMT has pledged to work hard to maintain peace in the region. China views Taiwan part of its territory, but tensions between the two rose to their highest level in years in August after Beijing staged massive military drills around Taiwan to protest a visit to the island by U.S. House Speaker Pelosi. Several European countries have renewed promises of support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Leaders from Poland, Lithuania, and Belgium were in Kiev expressing support for the Ukrainians on the 90th anniversary of the Holodomor famine. Based on Belgian media, Brussels has pledged nearly $40 million in financial aid for Kiev. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz also said in a video statement that Berlin will give over $10 million to the Ukrainians to help them with exports of grain. On Friday, NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg urged a military alliance to step up support for Ukraine. NATO allies have already funneled billions of dollars worth of arms to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Bacterial infections are the second leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 1 in 8 of all deaths in 2019. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, bacterial infections are the second leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 1 in 8 of all deaths in 2019, the first global estimate of their lethality revealed recently. The massive new study published in the Lancet Journal looked at deaths from 33 common bacterial pathogens and 11 types of infection across 204 countries and territories. The pathogens were associated with 7.7 million deaths, 13.6% of the global total. In 2019, the year before the COVID-19 pandemic took off, that made them the second leading cause of death after ischemic heart disease, which includes heart attacks, the study said. Just 5 of the 33 bacteria were responsible for half of those deaths. Staphylococcus, Itria coli, and pneumonia, and S. aureus is a bacterium common in human skin and nostrils, but behind a range of illnesses, while E. coli commonly causes food poisoning. This study was conducted under the framework of the Global Burden of Disease, a vast research program funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, involving thousands of researchers across the world. These new data for the first time reveal the full extent of the global public health challenge posed by bacterial infections, said a study co-author Christopher Murray, the director of the U.S.-based Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, adding, "It is of utmost importance to put these results on the radar of global health initiatives so that a deeper dive into these deadly pathogens can be conducted and proper investments are made to slash the number of deaths and infections." The authors called for increased funding, including for new vaccines, to lessen the number of deaths, also warning against unwarranted antibiotic use. Hand washing is among the measures advised to prevent infection. Also, Lancet publication noted, "We estimated deaths associated with 33 bacterial genera or species across 11 infectious syndromes in 2019 using methods from the Global Burden of Diseases, Injuries, and Risk Factors Study 2019, in addition to a subset of the input data described in the Global Burden of Antimicrobial Resistance 2019 study. This study included 343 million individual records or isolates covering 11,361 study location years. They used 3 modeling steps to estimate the number of deaths associated with each pathogen, deaths in which infection had a role, the fraction of deaths due to infection that are attributable to a given infectious syndrome, and the fraction of deaths due to an infectious syndrome that are attributable to a given pathogen. Estimates were produced for all ages and for males and females across 204 countries and territories in 2019. 95% uncertainty intervals were calculated for final estimates of death and infections associated with 33 bacterial pathogens following standard GPD methods by taking 2.5 and 79.5 percentiles across 1,000 posterior draws for each quantity of interest. According to Lancet, from an estimated 13.7 million infection-related deaths in 2019, there were 7.7 million deaths associated with the 33 bacterial pathogens, both resistant and susceptible to antimicrobials across 11 infectious syndromes estimated in this study. They estimated deaths associated with the 33 bacterial pathogens to comprise 13.6% of all global deaths and 56.2% of all sepsis-related deaths in 2019. The age standardized mortality rate associated with these bacterial pathogens was the highest in the sub-Saharan Africa superregion, with 230 deaths per 100,000 population, and lowest in the high-income superregion with 52.2 deaths per 100,000 population. S. aureus was the leading bacterial cause of death in 135 countries and was also associated with the most deaths in individuals older than 15 years globally. Among children younger than 5 years, S. pneumonia was the pathogen associated with the most deaths. In 2019, more than 6 million deaths occurred as a result of three bacterial infectious syndromes, with lower respiratory infections and bloodstream infections, each causing more than 2 million deaths, and peritoneal and intra-abdominal infections causing more than 1 million deaths.
Food for thought.
Salam to you all, and let us recite to you a widely recorded saying of the Prophet concerning his Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity has been vouchsafed by God Almighty in Ayah 33 of Surah Zab. The stars are a security for the people of the earth against drowning when at sea, while my Ahlul Bayt are a security to the people of earth against discord.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, power and its manifestations. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Among man's innate desires, mention can be made of the desire to wield power, the desire of power, to attain power, to be capable of performing deeds, and to have control over other beings. This desire also emerges in childhood and endures to the end of a person's life. Of course, this desire has degrees depending on the age differences, period of life, and external factors. A healthy infant's motions and movements of hands and feet and the untiring gambling of children are indications of this innate desire. It's a desire that most human beings do have from the very first day they step into this world. So by and by, range of man's quest for power increases, extending to infinity. The more he grows up or she grows up, that particular feeling of power, the will of power increases in them. At first, performing various deeds establishing power and extending strength occur by means of stimulating nerves and by muscles with the aid of natural powers alone. So these constant movements made by the child on instinct help increase his physical power. And as time goes by, his muscles become stronger and more ready to perform greater and more laborious functions. This goes on until he reaches the peak of youth and the climax of physical power. From then on, he faces the period of stagnation and inertia. Then comes the period of senility and old age. Gradually, the physical powers are exhausted, but the zest for power never dies down in the man. Power and manifestations is something that grows with the man from the younger age to when he is old. How can we control this?
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. We are talking about power and its manifestations. To extend the domain of his power, man does not suffice with natural powers. By the help of sciences and industries, man endeavors to find better services. He endeavors to find better devices to conquer the world and subjugate the universe. You know, like to take over the universe. It goes without saying that scientific discoveries and inventions, especially in recent times, have greatly contributed to the satisfaction of this inborn desire, and will later do so as well. Man does not even refrain from using the power of his fellow creatures, in as far as conditions and facilities can permit him. Man uses others for his own benefit, effort to reach social positions, and to be honored nationally. As well as the nation's demand for superiority at the international level. And all these are manifestations of this desire, which at times appear in a correct and sound form, while at other times it appears in the form of aggressions on the rights of others in various shapes of oppressive colonization and exploitation. So the quest for increased power does not stop at this level. Rather, it even embraces impeccable and metaphysical powers as well. Various branches of exotic sciences, like spiritism and different forms of sensual mathematics, are all indicative of man's wondrous efforts to develop his ability. Power is something that is an inbuilt feeling in a human being, and it has so many manifestations that, if not controlled very well, can lead to his demise. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
after repeated failed attempts, NASA has eventually launched Moon Rocket on its debut flight. NASA's next generation Moon Rocket blasted off from Florida, marking the start of the space agency's new program dubbed Artemis. An uncrewed Orion spaceship is fixed to the top of the 32-story tall Space Launch System rocket. It will be separated for a 25-day voyage around the moon and back without astronauts aboard. It was the third time after two previous launch attempts were cancelled for technical reasons. If the mission succeeds, a crewed Artemis II will orbit around the moon but not land on the surface in 2024. The third Artemis mission, scheduled for 2025, will be the first to put astronauts on the moon since Apollo's mission about five decades ago.
It's always a tricky task to remember people's names at a party, but not in this particular gathering in Tokyo, where all the guests had the exact same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. 178 Hirokazu Tanakas came together on Saturday to set a new namesake gathering world record. Their ages spanned from 3 years old to 80. The Guinness World Record for the largest gathering of people with the same first and last name previously belonged to Martha Stewart. 164 people with that name came together in New York in 2005. In the Tanaka's gathering, every man was assigned an alias inspired by their hobbies, occupation, or favorite foods to tell them apart from others. One nicknamed by his birthplace says, "It's strange to meet so many people with the same name." Obviously.
It's a strange feeling to know that there are nearly 200 people with the same name. To be honest, I'd presume there are more popular names out there like Suzuki and Sato. This achievement is really because of the efforts of our organizer.
The man who organized this gathering is a 53-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka who has worked for years to make this happen. He says his quest began in 1994 when he stumbled upon news about a baseball prodigy with the same name. After that, he began tirelessly scouring the nation for his namesakes. He then founded the Hirokazu Tanaka campaign that brought the men together and created a strange friendship among them.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art, which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines, and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones, which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture.
Thousands of baby turtles have been released into Peru's Amazon basin in an attempt to preserve the rainforest ecosystem. More than 6,000 hatchlings of three endangered species of turtles have been released into lakes and lagoons in Peru to help them repopulate. To make this happen, wildlife officials collected the eggs from their natural habitat and transferred them to artificial beaches until they hatched. The river turtles are considered vulnerable because for many years they have been killed for human consumption or kept as pets. Scientists are currently trying to conserve the Amazon to avoid catastrophic climate change, and Peru has the second largest share of the rainforest after Brazil. Another world record news. This time it has been set in Switzerland. A Swiss railway company has run the world's longest passenger train with a trip on one of the most spectacular tracks through the Alps. To celebrate its 175th anniversary, Switzerland's rail industry launched the world's longest ever passenger train, measuring around 2 kilometers. The electric train took almost an hour to cover around 25 kilometers over the UNESCO World Heritage Albula line in eastern Switzerland. The Albula line is famous for its endless swooping curves and steep descents. Rail enthusiasts lined the valley to watch the train's 100 cars snake through the Alps. Belgium and the Netherlands were the previous record holders for the world's longest passenger train. They used standard railway through the flat landscapes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Iran has hosted an international student scientific contest dubbed Noor or Light. The annual event seeks to promote science among children and scout for child prodigies. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
They have only 1 minute to present a scientific idea in their homemade clips. Over 1,300 teenage science enthusiasts from 19 countries participated in Iran's Noor competition, a scientific contest for school students. The fifth edition of the event was themed with optical illusion and mathematical modeling. The top 100 videos were awarded during this closing ceremony in Tehran.
My work is titled The Bouncing Ball. We painted a long oval and a shadow under it. When we film it from a certain angle, it takes the shape of a levitating ball.
Our work is about an optical illusion. We created a set of conjoining cylinders that appeared to change shape in the mirror. The idea was first created by a Japanese engineer in 2016.
The most creative videos win the prize. They should be both educational and mind-blowing, like this floating Rubik's Cube, which appears to be levitating, but then turns out to be just an origami work.
We have two levels of the competition. One is the kind of general competition for the crowd, and many students can contribute on that, in that. And we have other level, which is for elites. And in that level, we have more sophisticated competition between elite.
Organizers say participants in Noor contest are not supposed to make breakthroughs. The main goal, they say, is to engage them in science and let them experience the excitement of scientific experiments.
Try to make these teenagers learn how they can think about science for the welfare of human beings and how they can apply it for them.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation is the organizer of this scientific event. The foundation also holds the biennial Mustafa Prize, which awards cash prizes to top scientists from across the Muslim world, whose accomplishments contribute to the welfare of human beings. Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation, as the organizer of Noor competition, says prodigies are everywhere. They just need to be discovered. It says this contest is a platform that's specially designed to scout for teenage minds and give them a chance to shine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Chinese aerobatic teams have been performing jaw-dropping stunts to mark the 73rd anniversary of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. Pilots wowed the audience with their complicated maneuvers, such as swooping close to the ground, making loops and rolls. Aerobatic teams use red, yellow and blue smoke trails representing the flag of the Chinese Air Force. The Hongying aerobatic team, also known as the Red Eagle, is made up of 10 JL-8 trainer planes and 20 pilots from the Air Force Aviation University. The performance was part of China's International Aviation and Aerospace Exhibition held in southern China. The exhibit typically draws thousands of participants in the field of aviation from countries all over the world. Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plan to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle. Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Torbat Haydariya.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Since the 2008 global financial recession, Europe lost its resources and had no hope of being revived completely. In his recent speech, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has claimed neither the COVID-19 pandemic nor Russia-Ukraine conflict has played a pivotal role in bringing about the current economic downturn in Europe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, neither the COVID-19 pandemic nor Russia-Ukraine conflict has played a pivotal role in bringing about the current economic downturn in Europe. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has argued. He'd attributed it to growth in Asia instead, warning that there likely will be a return to the good old days in the foreseeable future. Speaking recently at an economic summit in Berlin organized by Stuttgart, Scholz said that for years countries in North America and Europe had enjoyed a combination of stable growth, low inflation and high employment rates. This, however, according to the chancellor, was an economic exception that cannot be expected to last any longer. Russia-Ukraine conflict and the economic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic may have expedited the end of this era. The politician opined, saying they were not the trigger for it. Scholz went on to explain that for decades, countries such as Vietnam and Indonesia have mainly been viewed as a source of cheap goods for the European, American, and increasingly the Chinese markets. But in the meantime, the same Asian nations experienced an explosive increase in the number of people belonging to the middle class. Those individuals' purchasing power rose accordingly. This, the German chancellor postulated, is what has led to growing inflation elsewhere. He noted that at the same time, this is a major story of success enabled by globalization. He also warned against deglobalization, calling on Germany and other European nations to embrace more trade with emerging economies, of course, trade by fair rules. An increasingly multipolar world is arranging itself right now, fundamentally anew. A development which is best seen in Southeast Asia, Scholz argued. He hastened to reassure German businesses that they have nothing to fear as their goods will remain in high demand in this new world and they only stand to gain more. Speaking of the current energy crisis in his country, Scholz accused Russia of weaponizing gas exports, adding that Germany had made a mistake in relying too much on one supplier. He vowed that Berlin will never repeat this going forward, meaning that dependence on China will have to be reduced as well. Germany, he said, needs to look for new suppliers and markets for its goods. The chancellor promised to make sure Europe's economic powerhouse sees itself through the coming winter. Meanwhile, according to Euronews, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has recently said Europe's economy is projected to be badly hit by the energy crisis triggered by Russia-Ukraine conflict, with at least half of the 19 countries that use the euro heading for a recession. The horizon has darkened significantly over the last year, Kristalina Georgieva told Euronews recently, adding, 1 year ago, we were recovering from COVID and we finished with over 6% global growth and then two shocks. Omicron and Russia-Ukraine conflict have not only interrupted the recovery but reversed it. The number one priority is to fight and win against inflation. What does that mean? Tightening financial conditions, interest rates are going up, she noted, adding, when central banks are stepping on the brakes, finance ministers cannot press the accelerator. The IMF chief did not mince her words, saying the picture she painted of the global economy was unmistakably dark, with a worsening cost of living crisis and momentum slowing down in America and Asia. For Europe, the outlook is even bleaker. Europe is affected more severely by the increase of energy prices. The heat on European economies is such that we actually expect half of the countries in the Eurozone to experience at least two quarters of negative growth. In other words, a recession, she said, without naming the countries. A recession is generally defined as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. She said, just to give you a sense as to how significant the hit on Europe is, our pre-pandemic projections and our current projections differ by half a trillion euros. In other words, the loss of the European people is quite dramatic. In its latest outlook, the IMF estimated the Eurozone to expand by 3.1% in 2022, but just by a meager 0.5% in 2023. Next year, Germany and Italy are projected to post -0.3% and -0.2% rates, respectively. The managing director of the International Monetary Fund praised EU policymakers for providing targeted, timely, and temporary support for households and companies under financial stress and said the main focus should remain on energy savings to rebalance the supply-demand mismatch. But great challenges lie ahead for Europe. She declared, "I am not going to sugarcoat it. 2023 will be tougher than 2022 for Europe. Next winter for Europe may be even harsher than this winter."
Designing the Bomb.
Part 2.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. The managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics.